CEOs are often psychopaths. This hour, new research on whether that's fact or fiction. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also on the program, IPR's Clay Masters on the gubernatorial race. State data shows Iowa's new family planning program is providing fewer services like contraception. I'll talk with writers from India and Lithuania currently in residence in Iowa, and a conversation with Marshalltown native actor Toby Huss. He's in the new Halloween movie with Jamie Lee Curtis. Buckle up for your NewsBuzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's been a year since state lawmakers excluded Planned Parenthood clinics and other abortion providers from receiving funding. Now, recently released state data show that Iowa's new family planning program is providing fewer services like contraception. Barbara Rodriguez joins us, state government and politics reporter at the Des Moines Register. She's been writing about this along with her colleague, Tony Lays. Barbara, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So set the scene. Remind us of what lawmakers did a year ago in that 2017 session.
Well, essentially, at the time, they had long wanted to address what they viewed as a problem with supporting financially organizations that provide abortions. And so they had long wanted to remove state funding for organizations like Planned Parenthood. And so in the 2017 legislative session, they passed legislation that went so far as to remove, to just essentially give up federal Medicaid money in order to create a program, a family planning program that could exclude Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. And for those who don't know, Iowa's family planning program essentially helps poor and moderate income Iowans obtain reproductive health care like contraception, but does not pay for abortions.
Mm-hmm. So that's the new program that was set up to meet the needs that would not be met because Planned Parenthood wasn't getting this funding?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So the Des Moines Register requested data. You and your colleague, what did you discover in that data?
So we obtained data through a public records request that shows that just essentially fewer family planning services were being utilized since this new family planning program launched last summer, or specifically the summer of 2017. And it shows that the ripple effect of that is that the state is paying for fewer than a third as many birth control pills and hormonal implants and sort of other related services as it previously did. And it shows, the data shows also that, there are fewer people enrolled in the program and fewer healthcare providers seeking reimbursement for services as a result. The state of Iowa or the legislature set aside roughly $3 million for this program, and the data now shows that more than $2 million of that money has gone unused in the budget year that finished this past summer.
Mm-hmm. And in your article, if our listeners haven't already connected the dots here, preventing unintended pregnancies through contraception reduces the demand for abortions, right?
Correct. That's part of the concern that some of the various healthcare officials outside of state government that we spoke to for this reporting, they've expressed that concern that ultimately this is going to potentially lead to circumstances where we have, more unintended pregnancies. And so that data, that's not part of this reporting here, but it's, this data is a snapshot that could ultimately be linked to looking into that down the road as more time and data becomes available.
Mm-hmm. Whose perspectives did you get on the data that you uncovered here?
In part, we spoke with the Iowa Family Planning Council, a private nonprofit group that distributes federal money for family planning services, and they had been involved in collecting data, actually working alongside the state to collect some data on this new program. And the executive director of that council expressed some concern that ultimately this could imply that people aren't getting the services that they need. And so that was one of the individuals that we spoke to for the reporting.
Mm-hmm. Proponents, if we remember, of this change predicted that other healthcare providers would offer comparable birth control services. Did you speak to any of those who were proponents of this change to get their reaction?
My understanding is that we did attempt to reach out to some lawmakers who had spoken on the in the legislature about this, but ultimately, at this point, we're still like processing what the data means. It does show ultimately that if there are fewer services being utilized, there are fewer healthcare providers participating in the program. And so that argument that was made during the legislative session gets complicated, and it doesn't add up.
Mm-hmm. What does the Iowa Department of Human Services say about this?
So, you know, it should be noted that the department has long known that there has been some preliminary data that indicates that there has been some kind of drop in participation in the program. They compiled data actually in January of this year that showed preliminary results that showed a decline in participation. And at the time, they noted a trend that is part of the program, which is that some individuals aren't utilizing this program because they're seeking services through the Affordable Care Act. But as some, you know, officials have noted, specifically healthcare officials outside of state government, that can't explain the extent of the drop in participation. But the Department of Human Services has acknowledged this data, and they've also noted that, you know, there's a lot of different factors at play here, and they do hope that it's going to bounce back. Specifically, there was a hospital system that was excluded from the program alongside with Planned Parenthood, in part because some of its locations did provide abortions, and so they're now enrolled back into the program. And so there's not necessarily a lot of data yet to see what that will mean to program participation now that this hospital system is back into the swing of things.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure listeners are aware of what you mentioned at the outset and what we talked about last year when this bill was being debated, that the state has foregone several million dollars in Medicaid money to make this move, right?
Correct. And it's Iowa's fairly unique in this, actually, because there's just a handful of states that decided to take this path to actively give up federal money. And it was a contentious issue in the Republican-controlled legislature, in part because Democrats pointed out that the legislature doesn't have the money to do this because there are so many other issues that they need to address financially. And Republicans sort of countered that point by saying that this was a priority, that they were willing to set aside, you know, $3 million worth of state dollars to do this, even if it meant giving up federal money. So it's not something that a lot of states have done. And, you know, we're still, I think, understanding the ramifications of that. And then again, the point here now is that we have a year that's passed. And so we have more complete data that shows a drop in participation and enrollment and services. And so it's going to be interesting to see what the legislature does with this data, with this information.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, it seems like a starting point to unlocking this data, the Des Moines Register, having this data released and doing the initial sort of investigation on it and what it all means. This means follow-up stories, follow-up investigations, right?
Right. And, you know, it's going to mean mounting political pressure because, again, the legislature, which is Republican-controlled now, they have really made abortion a top issue in terms of the policy that they're enacting. You know, they passed that six-week ban on abortions. It's not in effect, that law, amid this, you know, lawsuit. But Planned Parenthood has already, you know, pointed to our reporting and called on the legislature to reverse course on the funding of the program to include them back. But also, you know, Democrats potentially could use this as a point to talk about reproductive health care services and how Republicans are handling the topic at the legislature. And I think one other thing, too, is I kind of want to note that my colleague and I, you know, obtained this data through a public records request. And so it took weeks to obtain, and it wasn't readily available through the state agency. And so, you know, the Department of Human Services has pointed to the fact that state law doesn't require them to collect or analyze this data or to provide it to the public. So it'll be interesting to see if the legislature, you know, might consider making it a requirement that, you know, the state agency does collect this data and provides it in a digestible manner to the public.
Well, Barbara Rodriguez, we'll look forward to what you and your colleague Tony Lays at the Des Moines Register follow up with on reporting in this story of new data showing Iowa's new family planning program providing fewer services like contraception. Thank you, Barbara, and thanks for joining us. Even though you have a bit of a cold, we can hear in your voice. We wish you well to get over that cold.
Thank you, and thanks again for having me on.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, candidates for governor in our state met for the second of three televised debates this week. That was on Wednesday. They sparred over issues, a number of issues, abortion, medical cannabis, sexual harassment in state government. Of course, our candidates, Kim Reynolds, the Republican incumbent, and Fred Hubbell, her Democratic challenger. IPR's Clay Masters joins me now to talk about it. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
We're 2.5 weeks out from this election. Give us a sense of the debate highlights, the back and forth there.
Well, a lot of the second gubernatorial debate there in Sioux City between Governor Kim Reynolds and Democratic challenger Fred Hubbell, a lot of it was what we've already heard a lot from the two candidates that we've seen a lot in their ads. Their opening statements were very much the statements that you've been hearing on the campaign trail. But there were a few chances for them to kind of engage with one another. Of course, if you've been following the race, none of this would have surprised you. Governor Reynolds touting the $127 million surplus, talking about Iowa's 2.5% unemployment rate being so low. And of course, Fred Hubbell was highlighting what he sees as the financial mismanagement of Iowa's state budget and talking about eliminating wasteful tax giveaways for corporations. So there were a couple times where the two of them were able to interact in a way that you kind of just saw how they fought with one another. But for the most part, this is an opportunity to motivate the base. There aren't a whole lot of people that really are watching these debates that have not already made their minds up.
Right. And we have to agree that one of the decisive factors here will be just who turns out to vote. I have to imagine both campaigns are trying to get out the vote, knocking on doors, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is the time really when people start paying attention to the election. People like you and me, Ben, we spend a lot of time talking about the election, but now is the time that voters are finally starting to wake up, so to speak. Of course, early voting has already started, but people are canvassing, people are getting out there, making phone calls, the normal stuff that you'd be imagining would be happening this time of year. And of course, remember, this is a big year for Democrats to try to take control of at least one chamber in the Iowa House or Senate, hoping to get back the governor's office. And so we've been seeing a lot of high-level Democrats coming into the state. Not all of them have been for Fred Hubbell. There was Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, who's also the chair of the Democratic Governors Association, was here over the weekend having breakfast with him. And I shadowed him in Grinnell meeting with supporters. He was also in, I believe, Washington County as well as Johnson County. Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey was here for that fall gala, which feels like months ago, but it was really, I guess, just earlier this month.
Yep.
He was there speaking in support of Fred Hubbell. So at the same time, too, you know, last week I was talking to you about President Trump being in the state and advocating voters to turn out and vote for Governor Kim Reynolds. And then today, later this afternoon, Vice President Mike Pence is primarily here to campaign for 3rd District Republican incumbent Congressman David Young, but Governor Kim Reynolds is scheduled to speak at that as well. So lots of canvassing, lots of volunteering, and surrogates coming in and really trying to drum up support ahead of November 6th.
Based on the people you've spoken with, and I know you talk with a host of political analysts as well, does the president's popularity, the national narrative, impact this race?
Oh, definitely. And I think you're going to see, especially the, when you think about that NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that came out recently that showed that Republicans are now more than ever energized for this midterm. Before, there had been a lot of Democratic enthusiasm that pollsters had been pointing to. But with the Supreme Court nominee hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, that's energized a lot of Republican voters. So I do think that the Democrats are going to continue to try to point to the tariffs and their impact that they've had on a state like Iowa from the Trump administration. They're going to continue to try to hammer away at that. Republicans are pointing to things like the USMCA, or what we call NAFTA 2.0, and the E15 agreement that the president came to Council Bluffs to talk about. They're going to point to that as positive things that show that the president is staying course. And we have seen, you know, the Iowa poll recently showing, the Iowa poll published in the Des Moines Register showing that Trump's approval ratings in the state are, you know, less than stellar.
Right. Okay. But this race, judged by all out there, I mean, within the margin of error of whatever poll you look at, Clay, you're not seeing anything different. This is a toss-up.
I think so. You know, 538 had something that said that it was leaning Democratic. I think maybe it even said likely Democratic. I don't have it in front of me. But, I mean, I still feel like both campaigns are treating this like a toss-up. I don't think either of the campaigns are taking for granted anything. They're going to be hammering away up until November 6th.
IPR's Clay Masters. Thanks for joining us, Clay.
Yeah, thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, Chief Executive Officer. CEO is the profession with the most psychopaths. One in five CEOs is a psychopath, study finds. Well, it's headlines like these that caught the attention of an ISU researcher and researchers at the University of Alabama. They wanted to look into these claims about impulsive or vengeful bosses being psychopaths and find out what implications there may be for the workplace. Marcus Creedy is with me, assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University. He's worked with a couple of researchers at the University of Alabama, Peter Harms and Karen Landay, on some metadata, a meta-analysis. It's published in the journal Applied Psychology. Marcus, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, what specifically did you look at?
Well, we were interested in examining sort of the question you outlined, whether there's any truth to this widespread belief that a lot of managers and CEOs have these psychopathic tendencies that people are concerned about.
Mm-hmm. So let's define psychopathic. That's an outdated term, right, for sociopath? Isn't that used as well?
Well, the two are a little bit different. And what we were concerned about was not so much sort of the clinical use of psychopathy, because very few of those people end up in employment. We were interested in sort of elevated levels of those traits. So most of us are somewhere on the spectrum, and our interest was in people who perhaps scored a little bit higher than most of us on what's termed a constellation of traits that define psychopathic tendencies. And there's really kind of three aspects to it. The first one is often called fearless dominance, which is sort of a desire and willingness to take charge in social settings, take risks, be charming, lack anxiety. And the other two are impulsivity and lack of empathy. And so those three kind of define somebody who may have elevated levels of psychopathic tendencies.
Okay, what did you find? Is this a myth is there some truth to it?
It's largely a myth with a little bit of truth. So we really didn't find any evidence to suggest that, you know, the executive suite is staffed by people with very high levels of psychopathic tendencies. What we did find was sort of a very a slight tendency for people who score higher on these traits to be more likely to become managers and CEOs. So it sort of improved your odds a little bit. And it also made it more likely that you'd be judged ineffective by your peers and subordinates. But again, the effects were nothing like is represented in sort of the popular literature.
Mm-hmm. So tie this together as a psychologist, as a professor of psychology, does it make sense that these particular traits, psychological traits, would work well for leaders, especially leaders of large companies?
Well, I think you have to break it down into the specific sort of the facets of it. I think the fearless dominance part I could definitely see as being something that is really helpful in that leadership position. So somebody's willing to take charge in social settings and perhaps doesn't worry too much about consequences of actions that he or she is taking and is willing to take risks. I could definitely see that helping both in becoming a leader in the first place, sort of putting yourself forward, and then also being effective at your job. I think the impulsivity part and especially the lack of empathy is probably more harmful. Very few of us want leaders who are making impulsive decisions, and I think some of the corporate scandals that we've seen over the past decades probably reflect impulsivity on the parts of leaders. And then a lack of empathy probably leaves your followers fairly miserable in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm. In this study, this meta-analysis of 94 studies determining patterns of leadership of people with psychopathic tendencies, you found, I think it was a surprise, some gender disparity, how women in these positions are viewed as opposed to men.
Yes, it was unexpected for us. So the basic finding was that men who exhibit these tendencies don't get punished a whole lot. Subordinates and peers kind of accept those behaviors as being sort of part of the job. Women leaders who exhibited these behaviors tended to be punished. So they're viewed as less effective by their followers and by their peers. And that is probably because it sort of violates some prevailing gender norms. You know, women are supposed to be more empathetic, and so if that empathy is lacking, we judge them more harshly for it.
Mm-hmm. So what are the implications of these findings by you and the fellow researchers in Alabama for us in the workplace, and those listening who in particular may feel they live under a tyranny as they work with an impulsive or vengeful boss?
Well, we've done some prior work on what we called at the time abusive supervision, and we demonstrated also with a similar meta-analysis that the consequences of having an abusive supervisor or manager can be quite severe on your mental well-being. Sort of burnout rates go up and stress goes up. But I guess for organizations who are worried about this, there's kind of two broad things that we could think about doing. The first one is to screen for these kind of characteristics at the hiring stage. You know, there are tests that one can use. You can have interviews with former employers to try to get a sense of whether somebody has these characteristics. And then, you know, if you're promoting from within the organization, again, you can get peer ratings. You know, does this person behave in a manner that we would perhaps worry about if they were in a leadership position?
Right. And very quickly, we have less than a minute here. You can have psychopathic tendencies or traits, and you're not a killer. We know from Hollywood, we'll talk about that in just a minute, this is those traits combined with a bloodlust, right?
That would be our biggest concern, yes. And again, most of us have some level of these traits, you know, especially most people would say they have some level of impulsivity or they're comfortable in social settings. So we're not worried about people who have slightly elevated levels of this. I think it's once you get to the extreme high levels that the real concern kicks in.
Okay, fascinating. Quick, what would be your follow-up studies here? What are you looking at?
Well, we're finishing up a study right now in which we're looking to see whether some of these leadership behaviors are received differently in different countries.
Okay.
And not at the point yet where we can be certain about what the findings are, but it looks very interesting.
Fascinating work. Marcus Creedy, assistant professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Look for the results of their meta-analysis published in the Journal of Applied Psychology. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been 40 years since the original Halloween movie terrified us. Now Halloween is back. Laurie Strode, played by Jamie Lee Curtis, survived that vicious attack from the crazed killer Michael Myers at Halloween night 40 years ago. He's been locked up in an institution but manages to escape, of course. In just a moment, we'll be back. I'll talk with Marshalltown native Toby Huss. He's in the new Halloween movie with Jamie Lee Curtis, which opens today. Stay tuned. My palms are getting sweaty already. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Do you remember the 1978 movie Halloween? That classic slasher film directed by John Carpenter and starring Jamie Lee Curtis? Not likely you would forget it if you had seen it. Well, it's been 40 years since that original Halloween movie terrified us. And now, crazed killer Michael Myers is back. He's been locked up in an institution, but in this film manages to escape when his bus transfer goes horribly wrong.
The bus crashed.
Michael Myers escaped.
He'll return to Haddonfield, his home.
I need to protect my family.
Marshalltown native Toby Huss is in the new Halloween movie with Jamie Lee Curtis, and he joins me now. Hi, Toby.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. We have to disclose here, because we do this on public radio, I want to disclose. We are old friends from college days, and so it's great to talk with you.
Thank you. Yeah, you too, man. Yeah, it's been a long time.
Tell us a little bit about the new Halloween, 40 years after the original in 1978, with John Carpenter as the director, Jamie Lee Curtis, of course, in that famous film. This one, 40 years later, Michael's Homecoming. Tell us a little bit about the premise here.
Well, you know, again, poor Michael's still locked up in a psych ward, a mental health facility, I think it'd be called. And they try to transfer him to a new mental health facility. And, of course, something goes horribly wrong. And he seems to start walking around, and it seems to be around Halloween time, and then all hell breaks loose. You know how it works.
Right.
That's sort of the premise. But Jamie Lee Curtis is in it, and she's been kind of waiting for this moment her whole life so she can finally kill him. Mm-hmm. But it's taken a psychic toll on her because she's really suffering from some serious PTSD from this guy, and it's influenced her life, and it's really hurt her family and her relationships with her daughter, who is my wife, played by Judy Greer, and her granddaughter, our daughter, me and Judy's daughter, Andy Matichik. So it is a tale of sort of survivors and abuse and this how this matriarchy is trying to carry on.
Right. So your character is named Ray. You are the son-in-law of the Jamie Lee Curtis character. Is this Laurie Strode?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I married into that crazy foot-upon family.
Now, I don't want to give anything away, and I'm sure you don't want to either, but judging by seeing you in the trailer and some stills online, you have an encounter with Michael Myers.
Well, yeah, I guess you could say that. I'm not going to say who wins that encounter, but we do meet each other. Yes, Michael and I do. Sure. I think you can guess where it goes, but you should go see it anyway.
Oh, absolutely! It opens today across the country. I will be there in the theater. I'm going to try to figure out who I bring along, whose hand I can hold.
Sure. Yeah.
John.
Well, I tell you, it's a good movie. So they showed it the other night in Los Angeles. We had the premiere on Wednesday, and it was fun. And they dressed a guy up, and there was a party afterward at the like poolside at the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel. And there were, you know, hundreds of people there. And there's a balcony on the second floor that overlooks the pool. And some guy dressed up as the Shape, is what we call him, Michael Myers, with his mechanics uniform on and the mask, was just wandering around the balcony. And even though you're at a party and it's not a movie, it's super creepy seeing a guy with that mask walk around and say nothing and stare at you. It's a little unnerving.
Right. And times have changed in 40 years. You know, I'm sure there were murders in 1978 when we were teens, and there were serial killers in 1978. But times have changed in terms of violence. We have a lot of very real violence in our culture today. And I wonder if you and the cast and the director here, David Gordon Green, if you talked about that, if you had to be in any way, this is a slasher film, but do slasher films change when sensitivities change in a culture?
I think they should, but I think this is a little bit of an anomaly because it's kind of the American, it's worked its way into the American id these days, you know? So it's just this, it's almost a fairy tale. There's a weird moment that happens when Michael's walking around, he gets out and it's Halloween night and he's found his mask and he puts it on, he's got his mechanic in there and he's walking. It's in one of the trailers, so I'm not giving too much away. But he's walking down a driveway and there's a garage in the back with a garage door open up and a bunch of tools. And you look and you see a woman in the house next to it. She's got her hair in curlers. And Michael just walks straight back to the back and he finds a hammer and he picks it up. And you get happy. It's the strangest reaction. You go, oh, yay, he's going to go smash her brains out with a hammer. This is going to be fun. And then he does it, and you feel sad. Oh, he shouldn't have killed her. But the moment he grabs the hammer, you sort of feel, you feel that there's a some awful, you know, terrifying circle has been completed, and it releases the happy endorphin, I guess. When you see it, it's a satisfying, maybe satisfying is the way to do it, to say it.
Okay.
But it's still awful. He's going to murder.
Right. Based on what you just said, Toby, you're a Marshalltown native. I think we might have to revoke your Iowa Nice credentials.
I know. I might have to. I'm going to have to give those up these days. It's a thing. But you'll see it, and you'll be sitting in the theater, and I guarantee some people will cheer.
Really?
They will cheer. When Michael picks up the hammer, it's going to make you happy. It's awful. It's an awful base human reaction, but we have it.
Okay.
But then, you know, there's a possibility, let's say, of him getting his comeuppance in the end, and that makes you much happier.
Yes. Give me a story, as I mentioned, not John Carpenter at the helm here, David Gordon Green, director.
Yeah.
Of course, Jamie Lee Curtis, many other stars in this film, along with you. Do you have a story from the set that you can tell us?
Sure. Yeah, David was fun to work with. I'm actually working on a different project that he's producing in New York right now about Emily Dickinson. So he's sort of stylistically and culturally all over the map. But we were on the set one day, and we were doing the scene, and it was just Jamie Lee coming into a room with Judy Greer and I, and it's toward the end, and she's saying, hey, we got the sheriff here, and Michael's out. You guys got to come with me now. It's dangerous. And we were just sort of, oh, okay, patronizing mom. All right, crazy lady. We'll come when we get there. And the scene was working, but not as well as David wanted to. And he asked Jamie to try to, you know, start low and then go high. Let's try to build the scene in terms of intensity of emotion. And she kind of did it and kind of didn't do it. And it wasn't what David wanted, I think. But David's the kind of director that if he can't get exactly what he wants, then he'll at least try to do something unusual to get something weird. So we had a few scenes. Judy Greer and I, we were, you know, calming Laurie Strode down. Hey, relax. We don't want to have a sound. And then David said, hey, Toby, Judy, do this take like robots. And Judy went, what? And I said, yeah, robots. That's perfect. Jamie Lee went, what? And then he said, roll the cameras. And then Judy and I proceeded to do a take like robots.
And was that the take that made the film?
No, because it was too weird. But the reaction of Jamie might have been perfect, or the take after that might have been perfect. It was just a way to get the actors to do something other than what they were doing without just saying, do something different this time. Mm. So it was a pretty savvy move by a cagey director. And that scene is in the movie briefly, like her reaction, but you'd never know that she was reacting to two dummies acting like robots.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you about Marshalltown. Of course, Marshalltown, a tragedy this Ooh, summer boy. in July. Marshalltown still recovering, cleaning up after that EF3 tornado that ripped through the town, right through the middle of it, right in July. You went back to see the damage in your hometown, Marshalltown, right?
Yeah, I went back and we helped out, and it was pretty tragic as it lopped off the top of our county courthouse, which is really a symbol of that town. It's so heartbreaking. And the other thing, there were photos from our hometown that looked like Hurricane Katrina, that looked like Michael down there in the Texas or the Florida Panhandle. It's so sad. There was just absolute destruction through parts of town. And went back, and the Habitat for Humanity people were really great showing up, and we worked with them. Tony Trout, you remember Tony Trout, he came back too. So Tony Trout and I just lended a hand and did what we could. And, you know, but unfortunately, or fortunately, we got to leave because we don't live there. But the people who were in Marshalltown and Pella got hit pretty hard too. They need help, and they things aren't going to be back to normal for these people. They were in poor parts of town, and hundreds of homes were destroyed, and thousands of trees were just decimated. So the town, I think, going forward, it physically is just going to look differently for the next many years or something. But there's a lot of aid organizations you can give to that would be glad to take your money to help out these folks who are still trying to get on their feet.
All right. Marshalltown native Toby Huss, thanks for being with us for a few minutes to talk about the new Halloween movie, about other projects you're in. You're going off to, like, for instance, what do you have going to later today?
Oh, it's this. I'm doing a series for Apple TV about Emily Dickinson, and Haley Steinfeld is playing Emily, and I'm playing her father, and Jane Krakowski from 30 Rock is playing Emily's mother. So we're having we're shooting that in Brooklyn. And I think it'll be on Apple TV, they're saying maybe in the summer, something like that.
So
it's 10 episodes of The Wonderment of Emily Dickinson, which is a pretty incredible woman.
Toby Huss, we'll let you get to it. Thanks so much for your time, my friend.
All right, pal. Take care.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, for over 10 weeks, 28 writers from 27 different countries have been here in Iowa. They're taking part in a residency at the University of Iowa's International Writing Program. Here on River to River, we've been featuring conversations I had with several of them at a gathering to welcome the group of established writers from around the world. That gathering was back in August. Let's meet another one of the writers, this one from Lithuania.
So, okay, my name is Aušra Kaziliūnaitė, and I am from Lithuania.
From Lithuania, okay. Tell us a little bit about the nature of your writing. What do you write about?
Actually, I am a poet, and I already published 4 of my books, and my poetry is kind of experimental. I'm using a lot of different ways to express what's happening in my head. I'm using numbers and pictures, and sometimes I'm creating sound poetry. So, but now in Iowa City, I want to finish my 5th poetry book and also to start write my first novel.
Okay, so you're taking the time here, the 10 weeks you have here, to work on your writing. Do you have in your head, I'm putting you on the spot, I realize, do you have any poetry that you could give us an example of what your poetry sounds like? Is it in your native tongue?
Oh, no, you know, sorry, but usually when people ask me to, you know, read my poetry from memory, for me it's not easy to do.
Okay.
But for sure, I think it would be some opportunities or events where people can come and listen to my poetry, because I really like to scream sometimes when I'm reading and to do strange things, so maybe it can be interesting for some crazy people as well.
So it sounds like it's also poetry, but also performance art.
Yeah, I'm also a performer.
Okay. And what do you do when you perform otherwise?
For example, last of my performance was called Universary, and it happened last year when I celebrated my 30th anniversary. So I was just, you know, feeding people and giving them cakes and reading my poetry at once and just, you know,
so
gazing them to eyes and doing.
So by anniversary, you mean what we would say is a birthday?
Yeah.
So your 30th birthday, so you gave people cake and so forth.
Yeah. And a lot of, you know, kind of nervous readings, because I was very nervous about becoming 30 years old, you know, and at that time.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about why you came to the IWP, this residency. What appeals to you about it?
For me, it's really interesting to meet a lot of different writers from different backgrounds, from different countries, because, you know, I'm traveling world, but for example, for me, it's first time in America, so I also want to learn more about American culture, not just from movies, but from, you know, living here. And also I want to finish my new book and to start one more new book, and also to had opportunity to meet a lot of interesting people from different countries and to learn more about what's happening in different countries and different literature fields as well.
You come to the United States in a very interesting political climate. What are your thoughts on this time? And of course, Lithuania is a member of the a member of NATO now, and of course, your country, our country, are all wrapped up in some very interesting geopolitics. What are your thoughts as you come to the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's one thing what we are reading on web papers or, you know, hearing, and maybe by living here, I can knew more about what's happening here. But so far, for me, it's strange because not just in my impression, not just in America, but also in Europe and in Latin America and a lot of places, a lot of kind of right-wing movements involve. And I think in some ways it's kind of dangerous because, you know, it's building walls between people, and I don't like this thing. I think that we shouldn't lose opportunity to speak with each other, you know, and to try to understand each other better, instead ignoring people or just saying, oh, it's our enemies and this is our fake friends now or something, you know. So,
have you been to the U.S. before this time?
Never. It's my first time.
So you, when did you arrive?
Actually, I arrived on Saturday evening, and my travel was about 26 hours long, and after I felt like zombie, and my first impression was about Iowa was kind of strange because Skylar, name of my driver, she just was driving me, and it was at night about 11 o'clock, and we saw I think maybe three raccoons, dead raccoons on a road, and I asked her what it's here, and she just said it means that you arrived in Midwest.
Very good. So your first impressions of the U.S., of Iowa, you've been here about 48 hours, it seems. What can you tell us about Iowans, about your home country, Lithuania, that may surprise us, that you think maybe we wouldn't know about the Baltic state of Lithuania?
I don't know. For example, so far for me, impressions are very good. I'm feeling, you know, very good, accepted, and a lot of people that I already met are very friendly and very nice. Actually, weather, it's a little bit challenging for me because in Lithuania, we don't have, you know, so hot summers. And for me, it's, I'm feeling like in sauna here, but I think it's kind of acclimatization thing, and maybe it will change in a few days. But I don't know. I think it's one interesting thing about Lithuania, was it's especially important for me as well, but you know, Lithuanian language is one of the oldest languages in the world, and it's a little bit connected, you know, with old Sanskrit. It's a little bit strange thing, and we're sharing a lot of words in common with almost same meanings, and so my language is very archaic, and very different from English and from almost all languages from Europe, and except the Latvian language. But it's just 3 million people who can understand Lithuanian. So, you know, it's kind of a tricky thing, but I'm really enjoying it, to writing in this kind of secret old language that no one understands. But this year, I was opener of London Book Fair, and they published my book, collection of my poetry in English. So now even English speakers can, you know, read my poetry because it's not a lot of, it's not very big audience in Lithuania.
So this is interesting. Your homeland, Lithuania, has the same population almost
like Iowa. Yeah, like Iowa. Before I Googled it about Iowa, and for me it was also, you know, kind of nice thing to know, because I thought, oh, it's so huge, you know, country, federation, United States, and I'm going here, oh my God, but after I Googled it, but Iowa is almost same size like Lithuania, and after I felt more relaxed, you know.
That's good. Well, your English is magnificent. Thank you very much for talking with us. I wonder if you can leave us with a little bit of, so that we can hear your native language, a little bit of Lithuanian. What? Tell us something in Lithuania. Tell us about the evening. We have sort of a rainy evening, huh?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I will try. Šiandien labai lietinga ir ežeras atrodo nuostabiai.
And what did you say?
I said that today it's very rainy, and this lake, I'm not sure it's lake, but it looks very beautiful.
Excellent. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you. It was very nice to meet you.
That was a conversation from a couple months back that I had with writer Osha Kaluneta from Lithuania, just one of the 28 writers from 27 countries who are finishing up their residencies at the University of Iowa International Writing Program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Boone. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.